Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Right now, David Gura and Tom Keene in New York with Jonathan Golub of Credit Suisse. And on this Monday at 7:48 in the morning, maybe this is the equity interview of the week. John, you're not only optimistic, but you're double-digit optimistic. So few agree with you. What do they get wrong?
I think that there's this belief that if you're optimistic on stocks, you have to think that the economy is going to, you know, have this tremendous momentum behind it. And our view is that we are in a good economy, but that valuations will drift higher because the risks right now, especially around the potential for recession, are really much lower than average. Mm-hmm. And that lack of risk is what will push the stock market higher.
What's your counsel of how worried or cognizant we should be of recession risks at this point? What are you looking at, and what would you advise clients to do at this point when it comes to fear of or worry about a recession?
Yeah, so we put together this Credit Suisse recessionary dashboard, and we look at things like, is the yield curve flat or inverted? Absolutely not. Are jobs being created? Yes. Is inflation under control? Yes. Are you seeing construction activity improving as opposed to contracting? Yes. Are you seeing credit write-downs? Are corporations able to meet their debt obligations? Yes. If you look at each of these seven criteria, we are about as solid as we've ever been.
What role is the Fed playing in all of this? As you look at that dashboard, how much are you paying attention to what the central banks are doing, and what does the Jay Powell nomination mean for markets going forward?
Well, so that's two questions.
Mondays, folks, we don't do this.
Fair enough. Let's start with how cognizant you are of what the Fed is.
So since you asked, I'll answer in the other direction. But Powell really is a the market is perceiving it as a continuation of Yellen type governance. And so I think that alone probably means that it's not surprising that it got very, very little reaction. But there's this consensus view that the Fed ultimately is propping the market up by all of this money printing, and that if they stop printing, bad things are going to happen. And I disagree with that wholeheartedly. I think that the market is doing well because the economy is doing well. I think the Fed is actually responding to the economy as opposed to the other way around. And therefore, if they remove some accommodation, I think the market is going to be perfectly fine. But I will tell you, that's not the consensus view. The consensus view is, oh my God, they're going to remove liquidity, bad things are going to happen. And I just think that that's off base.
It's been almost a year since election night. You were around the building on election night as we did coverage of the results coming in. What have we learned about the markets in that year since? I'll ask you about the prospects for tax reform and all that in just a sec. But in terms of enthusiasm for policy, this administration, what have we learned in these intervening 365 days?
Well, a bunch of things. I mean, the one that's perhaps the most interesting is there was this belief that, and once we kind of shook off the surprise of the election, was that Trump was going to have this huge impact via tax changes. And the market has really taken the opposite side of that trade in the last 6 months. And more specifically, those companies that would benefit the most from tax changes have actually underperformed since his inauguration. And I think that's been a big surprise for many. So it was the market either saying one of two things: either I don't think that these are ever going to get implemented into law, or in year nine of a recovery cycle with an economy that's in pretty stable footing, maybe we don't need or want a big late cycle stimulus plan that would create inflationary pressure. So we can argue why the market's not celebrating this potential for tax reform, but that's what the market's saying.
going to ask you what companies stand to benefit the most should it get through. You've done a great list of all the companies you're following who have some upside here. But broadly speaking, what types of companies here would benefit most from tax reform?
Again, I think that we have to split this into two things. If you said that we're going to get tax reform, but we weren't going to get any inflationary pressure on the economy, and the Fed wasn't going to respond to the stimulus by tightening policy more than expected, then it would be companies that are more domestically oriented that can't avoid taxes offshore. And these could be, you know, retailers would be a good example. Those should be the biggest wins. And the biggest losers are industrial companies that do a lot of business offshore that have very low effective tax rates. But I think that the second issue is the more important one is, do you get some other feedback loop? And that's what investors very often miss. Things don't move in a straight line in investment land. So if this is stimulus, does that overheat the economy? Does that force a Fed? And that's the part that people may miss.
Headline crossing the Bloomberg here, we're talking about the president of the New York Fed, Bill Dudley, announcing his retirement mid-2018, that according to the New York Fed. So confirming what had been reported over the course of the weekend, as we mentioned, Tom, sitting down with the president of the New York Fed a little bit later today.
Well, yeah, I did a lunch for 400 people. let me explain to our global audience. It is always appropriate when the New York Fed president speaks to the Economic Club of New York. John, what's the question? I get to ask him questions, me and a good gentleman from The Economist magazine. What's the question you would ask the very retiring Bill Dudley?
You know, one of the perhaps more than anything else, and this is the guy who, remember, it's not that he runs the Fed, but he's the one who's in touch with the way the markets are going to respond to Fed policy. I'd want to get a better understanding of what it means if and when the Fed continues to move forward with balance sheet liquidation, and how do they how do they equate a little bit of tightening from the Fed funds rate with balance sheet liquidation? How do they weigh these against each other? How should the market perceive it?
I'll give Bloomberg Radio a first look at this. One of my questions will be, under crisis, how does a non-PhD listen to the fancy pants PhDs at the Fed, like the gentleman from Berkeley? I think with a 4 standard deviation move in John Golub's world, Dow down 21%, Dow down 17%, you pick the gloom, John. How does a non-economist chairman and Chairman Powell listen to people like Bill Dudley? And I think Bill's got real knowledge on that.
It's a great
is that question. Okay question?
No, it's a great question, and I think if you look at the the leadership of Fed by academics, I think that there's in hindsight, I'm sure that there's a lot of skepticism over the, you know, one is how they've dealt with the crisis, which I think they've gotten tremendously good marks on. And then what does the world look like after that when the world has returned to normal is a separate question.
Here's an email coming in, David Gura. Neil Soss on the short list to replace Bill Dudley. You're supposed to say, John, yes, Dr. Soss would be a wonderful selection.
We love Neil Soss.
Neil Soss, folks, is vice chairman of research for all of Credit Suisse.
I just want to note here.
Is extremely qualified.
Looking at the release here, Bill Dudley's term is expected to end in January of 2019. So Bill Dudley would be leaving here a bit early, mid-2018, he's saying. And a note here in the release from the New York Fed, a search will begin shortly, and they expect that search to conclude by mid-2018, depending on finding the best candidate. So we'll look for more clarity on that.
I'd have a moment of silence for Terry Lundgren, the Macy's CEO and also head of the Economic Club of New York, who's on the committee, and I believe he'll be on the committee at the New York Fed.
You didn't know this was happening?
No, I did not. I honestly, if I knew, I wouldn't tell you, but the answer is no, I had absolutely no clue at all. But I'll tell you, guys like Terry Lundgren are going to be absolutely inundated with names to take this extremely important a position, and I might point out a position under crisis. Bill Dudley, wonderful guy, will retire mid-2018 from the Fed, and again, he will speak. Matt Bessler and our team will have full coverage of that speech from the Economic Club of New York, and my questions to President Dudley have shifted from the minutiae to the bigger and broader. Coming up, Francine Lacroix in London, an exceptionally timely conversation with the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, in the news this weekend. David, what? Cyprus and Russia? Is that sort of
alleged ties to members of the Putin family as well.
Yeah.
He denying all of that being improper. Yeah. So we'll see what he has to say to Francine here in just a few minutes.
Maybe Mr. Ross can buy the New York Giants and put them out of their misery as well. Coming up, Wilbur Ross. Stay with us worldwide. This is Bloomberg. He has been on the show too many times as an industrialist, as a financier out of Yale University, Wilbur Ross, selected by the president to be Secretary of Commerce, best known over the last number of months for Ross Navarro, which was a white paper. He actually showed it to me at one point at an Economic Club of New York meeting. And that was controversial, to say the least. Now, more controversy with Secretary Ross over the weekend, his relationships with Russia and Cyprus. From London, here is Francine Lacroix with the secretary.
We need to talk about tax, but I also need to ask you about the Paradise Papers. You certainly, in the papers quite a lot today, you've retained investments in a shipping firm that has business ties to the son-in-law of the Russian president, but also an oligarch under sanction. With hindsight, should you have divested this stake?
Well, first of all, let me correct what you just said. We have no business ties to those Russian individuals who are under sanction. Prior to my joining the board of Navigator, they entered into some charter arrangements with Cyborg, which is a big Russian hydrocarbon company. I had nothing to do with the negotiations, never met the people under sanction. Cyborg never has been under sanction, so there's nothing whatsoever wrong with Navigator having a deal with them. Second, as to the disclosure, much has been made that it wasn't disclosed. It was in three places on my Form 278, which is a public document, at place 10.14.1.3, 10.15.1.3, and 24.1.4.2, as well as on the Office of Government Ethics website, public website. The symbol is OGE.gov.
Okay, couldn't be more clear. But with hindsight, again, there are allegations about ethics, about, you know, creating a conflict of interest. Do you think you should have divested this?
Well, there is no conflict of interest. We don't regulate shipping, and that's why the OGE let me retain shipping interests.
Would you welcome an investigation into this?
Investigate what?
But is there not an ethical question that needs to be raised? You've done nothing illegal, right? And that's very clear.
Nothing illegal, nothing even improper at all. The OGE came to an independent decision. Plus, before I meet with any corporate party, the OGE clears, A, that I can meet, and B, the extent to which I can participate in conversations. I have never sought a waiver from any of those strictures.
So, Secretary, you're keeping the stake?
I didn't say that. That's a different question. You're saying, anything improper? There's nothing improper either in the way we've handled meetings or in the investment itself.
Will you keep the stake?
Probably not. I have been actually selling it anyway, but that isn't because of this.
Talk to me a little bit about your upcoming trip to China. What is the president's stance on dealing with China when it comes to tariffs and steel?
Well, we are hoping for some specific deliverables. I'm leading a trade mission of some 29 U.S. companies over there. And we hope to come away with some very tangible and hopefully large deals for them.
What are you doing in London? Are you talking trade in post-Brexit?
Yeah, London is several different things. I spoke to the Trilateral Commission, speaking to the BCI, doing all kinds of things, as well as meeting with various government officials. And I went to the Balfour Centennial Dinner.
Okay. Secretary, if there is a Brexit that actually really rips out the UK out of the EU, how quickly can the US have a trade agreement with the UK?
Well, it should go pretty fast because while we can't negotiate right now, that's forbidden under EC rules, we do have a working group that met in July in Washington, is meeting next week here in London. So they're kind of scoping things out and going as far as they can without violating the EU regulation to make preparation.
Will you also talk with the opposition Labour Party in case there's a change of people in charge?
I think we'll be talking with whoever is the government.
Mr. Russ, one very last question. When you look about trade, we're expecting the status of the 232 investigation into imports of steel and aluminium. When will we get that?
Well, as the president has indicated, that will be sometime after the tax legislation is dealt with.
So that should be, when do you expect tax to be wrapped
up? Hopefully pretty soon.
So before Christmas?
We think it would be a wonderful Christmas present for the American business and consumer to get a tax reduction. So we hope so.
Secretary Ross in London with our Francine Lacroix. We might note the first interview, David, done from our new headquarters.
Is that right?
In London. I believe that was done by Mansion House there.
Excellent.
Down by Wardour Street or whatever. Not Wardour. I can't remember now. Mental block. Christopher Wren's church is right there. St. Stephen's as well. Speaking of St. Michael's here, Michael McKee.
St. Michael.
to talk to us Lord Dudley leaving the New York Fed. I want to go, Mike, just because of time, to how is a New York Fed president selected? The answer is it's a lot like the other banks, but boy, is it a different process in New York.
It's different than the Federal Reserve Board. We should make that clear. Members of the Federal Reserve Board, there's three openings now. If Janet Yellen leaves, there'll be four. Nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate. Individual Federal Reserve banks have boards of directors, and those boards of directors choose the person to be president. The Fed board in Washington has veto power, never exercised it on a nominee, but they do have to get approved by the Fed
board
in Washington.
To be clear, the president of the United States does not have
veto
power.
He has no role. Okay. The other thing is there are three classes of directors. Each Fed bank has nine directors, three classes. One class is bankers. At the New York Fed, it's James Gorman from Morgan Stanley.
Yeah, what's he know?
Paul Mello of Solvay Bank.
What's
and Jerry Lipkin of Valley National
what's
Bank.
He know?
None of those can take part. Only the other directors, the Class B directors who are finance and Class C directors who are, in theory, supposed to represent the public.
Emily Rafferty of the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
She's a Class C director. Sarah Horowitz is the chairman of the Fed's board of directors, New York Fed's board of directors. She's the executive director of the Freelancers Union. She's leading the search along with Glenn Hutchins, who is the co-founder of Silver Lake Partners.
In the news for other reasons today as well.
In the news for Broadcom and Qualcomm. This is like a free-for-all. Isn't it? I mean, let's be blunt here. The history of this over the last 20, 30 years is everybody piles on for their man or woman.
It's very interesting. The New York Fed, obviously the most important of the Fed banks, and so they tend to hire really big names. It's been a mixture of internal candidates over the years and external candidates. Two of the New York Fed's most prominent presidents, Jerry Corrigan and Paul Volcker, were president of the Minneapolis Fed when they were selected. And so some people are looking at Neel Kashkari and wondering what he's doing the next couple of years. Another name that's been floated is Robert Kaplan, who, of course, originally worked in the markets at Goldman Sachs, then was at Harvard for a long time and is now president of the Dallas Fed. You've got Simon Potter, who is head of the Open Markets Committee for the New York Fed, and that was the job Bill Dudley had before he became president. Brian Sack, a former head of the Open Markets Group, is also on the list. So some big names out there that are
Brian
well-known
Sachs
in finance.
Brian Sachs on the list?
He is.
No kidding.
He is on the talking points list. We don't have an official copy of Sarah Horowitz's list.
Are you on the list?
Always.
If
perennial,
nominated,
perennial.
I will not run if elected.
I was trying to sell Neil Sauss the last hour, the vice chairman at Credit. It'll be fun. This is a real exercise.
Is there a Jeffrey Lacker successor yet? Has that been there?
Not yet. Okay. We're still waiting for a Richmond Fed. Fair enough.
Michael McKee, thank you so much. Are you going to go to this soiree this afternoon?
I'm going to watch you on the
You can have half of Tom's role.
We'll see. Yeah. I need help with my questions from Michael McKee. It is tax reform time. It is a time where lots bloviate and a few actually have analysis. The Tax Policy Center, the Urban Institute, and Brookings Institute led for years William Gale and Gene Sterley, I should mention, as well. And in the trenches of our tax reform, tax cut, whatever it is Howard Gleckman. That's a name that you will begin to know over the coming weeks and months, and we're honored that the senior fellow at the Tax Policy Center joins us now. Howard, congratulations on the issue coming front and center for you. What is your single observation of where we are right now on this tax reform bill?
Well, as Donald Trump might have said, nobody knew tax reform would be this hard. This is a real challenge. It's particularly a real challenge for Republicans to do this on a partisan basis, because to pay for many of the tax cuts that they favor,
right,
need to get rid of tax preferences already in the law, and it's really hard to do that when you don't have political cover of a bipartisan bill.
Let me ask you just about what we know about the ramifications of this piece of legislation. Of course, the Tax Policy Center was in the crosshairs when Kevin Hassett made a trip there to speak to you and the Tax Foundation as well. And he was critical of the fact that y'all did some analysis early on that he thought was premature. We see this bill being rushed through committee. The chair of the House Ways and Means Committee says he wants to have it done by the 13th of November. Is it your sense that we're going to maybe have that happen without having a full sense of what this bill means?
I think that's true in the House. The House is on a fast track. They have the votes, and I suspect it'll move pretty quickly. The Senate, I think, is going to be a different story. I think the Senate's going to take quite a while to work its way through this bill, and I think there will be some opportunity to chew over many of the details. One of the things that we're all learning just in the last few days is that there are provisions in this bill that are enormously complicated. You know, while the supporters of the bill talked about simplification, and there is some simplification in here, there are things in here that are very, very complex, and people, even 4 or 5 days after the bill was first introduced, are just trying to figure out what they mean.
You have members of this administration guaranteeing that there will be no tax increases, tax cuts for the middle class. As you've seen it, is that possible from what you've read?
No. The problem with this bill is that the changes that they make are going to be very idiosyncratic. Whether you pay more tax or less tax, particularly if you're in the middle income, is going to depend a lot on a lot of specific circumstances. Where do you live? What's the makeup of your family? How many kids do you have? How do you make your living? So I think what we're going to find, and we hope to have an analysis of this within the next few days, I think what we're going to find is that for some middle-income people, it will be a small tax cut. For some middle-income people, it will be a small tax increase. And for some very high-income people, it will be a very big tax cut.
Howard Gleckman with us, the Tax Policy Center. To me, the elephant in the room here, Howard, is the $1.5 trillion number. Bill Gale writing on this weekend. Do you believe in that number, or are you out at the $2 trillion level like other analysts?
Oh, so I think that this proposal is likely to cost more than the $1.5 trillion now. The problem is they have built themselves this box. They have to, at the end of the day, pass a bill that increases the deficit or loses no more than $1.5 trillion.
Then how do they do that? What's the elephant in the room that goes out the big fat door?
So this is a lower the bridge or raise the river story. They can either do it by finding more tax preferences to get rid of, which is, I think, pretty unlikely, or the other way they do it is they make the tax cuts less generous. Many people believe, and I'm among them, that the 20% corporate tax rate in this bill is not going to survive. That by the time they're done, that corporate rate is going to be somewhere 26, 27, 28%.
I want to ask you just a logistical question here. I think there'll be a lot of people listening who don't have Washington experience, haven't lived there, and wonder how all of this can come together as quickly as it can, to go from nine pages to many hundreds of pages, to hammer out some of the complicated things that you're talking about in particular. How's all of this being done?
So this is, you often hear this phrase in Washington, regular order. And this was the idea that a bill would be introduced, there would be months of hearings in the committee, committee would spend time drafting the legislation. That's not what we're doing this time. What's happening this time is this bill was written in the back room by a handful of people. They are now shopping it to rank-and-file Republicans in the House, trying to get them on board. There will be a markup in the Ways and Means Committee, but it's going to be basically pro forma. It'll be a show, but most of the decisions have been made.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be jammed through the House. And the Senate process is going to be a little different. I think there'll be much more input from rank-and-file Republicans, at least, in the Senate bill.
Interesting.
And depending on what Chairman Hatch of the Senate Finance Committee does, there may even be some input from Democrats.
This is a first conversation. We're thrilled to bring you Howard Gleckman of the Tax Policy Center. He and his colleagues just do terrific work. I'll send out their internet site to their website. It's just, I can't say enough about the work. Howard Gleckman, Tax Policy Center.
Big news out of Riyadh in Saudi Arabia this week, and the new Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman overseeing an anti-corruption campaign, a consolidation of power, some might say. We saw many members of the kingdom arrested, imprisoned at the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh for an indefinite period of time. We're getting a list of who they are. Let's get some more perspective on this, for there's certainly some economic and market impact from it, from Mohammed Al-Yahya, who is with the Rafiq Hariri Center on the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. He joins us now by phone. What's just broadly speaking the import of all of this? I mentioned this is a consolidation of power on the one hand, an anti-corruption campaign on the other. Can they go together? Is it one or the other?
That's a good question, Tom. I think what you mentioned about generational change and economics is very important here. What's happening is a mix of everything. You can't remove politics from the equation when you're looking at a country that is undergoing an unprecedented transformation. Every rule is changing in Saudi Arabia right now. But what's most important is considering the economic implications of this anti-corruption crackdown that's happening. You know, corruption has cost Saudi Arabia many billions of dollars on an annual basis. We're talking about top-level government contracts, private sector contracts. We're talking about arms deals. It's a huge dollar amount that takes a toll on the Saudi economy. And this is why there's an economic imperative to crack down on it. There's economic benefit that's derived from this.
We have, Mohammed, a romance of Saudi Arabia going back to Lawrence of Arabia and all the other stereotypes that are wrong. What will shift here in rule of law?
Well, the laws have always existed against corruption in Saudi Arabia. Anti-corruption commissions have been introduced time and time again from the 70s throughout the 80s and the 90s. But the difference that is happening today is that these laws, these pre-existing laws, are being used against the top dogs, the bigwigs in the country. And that's the main criticism against previous anti-corruption drives. It seems to me that what the message is, the message that the Crown Prince and the new government is trying to send, is that this won't be tolerated. There will be no half measures to fight corruption. And they want to stave off this criticism that well-connected top-level princes and politicians are exempted from these laws.
You know, when I heard that princes and ministers had been imprisoned at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh, I thought immediately of the event that was held there just a couple of weeks ago, the Future Investment Initiative. Several thousand investors and business people from around the world came to Riyadh at the invitation there of the Saudi government. What's the message being sent here to investors? Is it at once counterintuitive? You have here this anti-corruption campaign, but there must be folks who are worried about the continuation of power and sort of stability of the country in light of all of this.
Well, this is a complex issue. I mean, one of the biggest obstacles to foreign investment and business within Saudi Arabia in the past has been precisely this issue of corruption. People don't know who to deal with. They don't know how the system of patronage in terms of corruption works. And for a very long time, this has been the main obstacle.
Yeah.
Today, that Band-Aid is being torn off in Saudi Arabia. Will that create a sense of uncertainty? Perhaps. But at the end of the day, the bottom line is that the message being sent is that corruption won't be tolerated, and that transparency is the name of the game going forward.
One final question, and I don't say it as a joke. Is Saudi Arabia solvent? Is the corruption so great that they don't have the wealth that we presume?
I don't think Saudi Arabia is solvent. Saudi Arabia still indeed has large foreign reserves and enormous financial capabilities. But that doesn't take away from the fact that the corruption costs Saudi Arabia a huge amount on an annual basis. I mean, the Deputy Crown Prince in the Vision 2030 plan set out to raise fuel subsidies, set out to roll back certain parts of salaries in the private sector. If you look at the dollar amount that these policies gave the government, they would pay it in comparison to what cracking down seriously on corruption would save the government in a dollar amount.
Great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much for the time today. As we get the perspective on what happened over the weekend in Saudi Arabia, in Riyadh. That was Muhammad Ali Akhya, who with the Atlantic Council, joining us there by phone from Washington, D.C. And as I said, Tom, something that'll bear watching. There's so much happening here with the president's trip to Asia, tax reform and all of that. But certainly in terms of geopolitical events, this seemed pretty seismic.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.